Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the KBOO Bike Show. I'm Steph Routh. With me today is co-host Tori Bortman. Good morning, Tori.
Good morning, Steph.
Many folks are heading into a wintry holiday season filled with weather, family, friends, and as much warmth and light as we can snag. Some people's traditions include shopping for holiday gifts. What does the bicycle have to do with our spending patterns? According to recent research by Kelly Clifton, how you get around has an impact on your spending habits. We are in a rare and lucky position to spend the entire hour discussing bikes and local businesses with one of the region's top scrutinizers on the topic. Kelly J. Clifton is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Portland State University. Dr. Clifton conducts research and teaches courses in various aspects of transportation planning and policy, including travel behavior, land use and transportation, physical activity and health, and travel survey methods. Like, what's left? Kelly, thank you very much for joining us, and welcome to the KBOO Bike Show.
Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to it for months.
No, us too. So how did you become interested in transportation research?
Well, it's a really long, not a linear story, but I started off my career as an energy researcher at the Department of Energy. And I spent a lot of time in the lab by myself, and I realized that perhaps that kind of inquiry really wasn't suited to me. And so one of the things I like about transportation is it combines a lot of different elements. So certainly science, engineering, but a lot of public policy as well as human behavior. So I got interested in it when I moved to Arizona to start my master's degree in urban planning. And I was fortunate enough to work with a woman, Sandy Rosenblum, who is my mentor. And she did a lot of research, or still does a lot of research, on transportation and women. And she hired me because I was an engineer who had statistical skills. And I really wasn't interested in transportation, but through that process, it opened my eyes to the various dimensions of transportation and that it's multifaceted, and I can't stop thinking about it. So.
Do you see the conversation as different in Arizona when you're talking about urban planning as in Portland? Because, I mean, those are two very different transportation environments.
The conversation in Portland is different than the conversation just about everywhere. I think it's different, but I think in general the concerns are still the same. So people are interested in having safe, efficient transportation systems. People are interested in sustainability. But I would say the political will is a more difficult. The urban form poses more challenges. Mm-hmm.
Which part of Arizona were you in?
I was in Tucson.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time in Tucson. It's interesting, challenges transportation-wise, for sure, because it's definitely not set up like Portland. It's a little more of a strip mall community.
Yeah, but it has some amazing advantages. So when I was there, I didn't have a car, so I was bike-free before it was bike-free. It was cool. And so it was the mid-90s, and Tucson was really a leader in investing in bike infrastructure. And they've kind of been off the radar for a while, but they've done some really innovative things, both in terms of cycling and in terms of pedestrians. And I think that the strip mall development, one of the things that I learned when I lived there is they've really adapted it to non-motorized transportation. So while Tucson has these huge boulevards that are Speedway Boulevard, I think is 8 lanes, and there is a bike lane. Mm-hmm. I used to bike down it. But what you'll find in a lot of these strip malls is access through the back. So if you are on the neighborhood side, you can walk or bike. So cars will come down the arterial and park in front, and that's the most visible part. But it's a great way to adapt the suburbs to non-motorized transportation. And I think that's a lesson that we could export
all
over the country.
I did not know the secret. I've spent spent a month down there usually every winter, and that's now I want to go explore. Is it like an alleyway behind?
I don't know what it's called now, but there's a strip mall on a Speedway that has done that. It used to have a Walgreens that had two entrances, so much like we see in like Fred Meyer or Safeway here, where you can go in on either entrance and it accommodates different modes. So I wouldn't say it's pervasive, but there are a few places that have done it, and it's really stuck in my head as something that we could really do to transform the suburbs everywhere.
Mm-hmm. So moving a little more to your study, how do you choose what to study?
Well, that's a great question. So I would like to say that it's entirely up to me what I study, but it's a nice compromise between my ideas and what I think about and then the funding opportunities that are out there. So,
yeah, you said you're thinking about transportation now all the time.
So yeah.
I'm curious what your recent... What's on your mind now?
I'm thinking a lot about this study on consumer behavior because it is as a sort of a first strike, it probably posed more questions than it answered. One of the fortunate things about being here and being at Portland State University is the OTREC, or the National Institute for Transportation and Communities.
And OTREC is the Oregon Transportation Research Education Consortium.
Exactly. And there's some confusion about those two organizations, but they're effectively one.
I'm not really familiar with either. What do they do?
Well, it's a federally funded research center. We are one of five in the nation, and our focus is on livability. And so it's about a little shy of $3.5 million a year and focuses on research and education around transportation. So one of the things that I'm fortunate to be a part of that organization is that when I have good ideas and I have community support for those ideas, I can apply for grants. So as opposed to sort of the typical research process where I'm responding to somebody else's idea mm-hmm. and have to sort of figure out innovative ways to get my ideas in there.
So specifically your recent research, examining consumer behavior and travel choices, how did that research come about? Was that your idea? Did someone approach you? How did that evolve?
Well, it was an evolving conversation with some of the staff at OTREC, as well as some staff at the PDC, actually, the Portland Development Commission. So they were really interested in this question of economic development and what role transportation plays in that. And so we talked about what could be done and what's possible within the confines of a year-long or year-and-a-half-long grant.
And what was the methodology? Could you kind of walk us through? Because this particular study has kind of taken on some serious legs, and I'm sure part of it is just because there are so many transportation geeks in the Portland region. But you know, I would be interested. You know, could you just walk us through?
Sure, absolutely. So one of the things we did with the study is leverage another study that I had ongoing with Metro because they're interested in the development process and how we impose fees on new development based on their transportation impacts. And we know that those systems don't really do a good job of accounting for development in urban areas that are more multimodal. For the data collection, we picked a number of establishments, and those were supermarkets, bars, restaurants, and convenience stores. So it seems a little random, and it's not that I'm obsessed with food and drink.
Unlike the rest of
them. Why those four?
Why those four? So in part because as new developments come in, those are some of the things that pose challenges to Metro and to cities in terms of how to properly evaluate their transportation impacts. And then one of the reasons why we didn't...
What kind of problems?
If you're citing a grocery store in the Pearl, the kinds of... or somewhere that's very sort of urban infill, or you're citing a new grocery store on Williams Avenue.
Like the new Seasons that
absolutely.
Just came in.
Or Uwajamaya that didn't happen.
Yeah. So the data and methods that are sort of this industry standard nationally are really based on more suburban locations. So what's going to happen is that it would overpredict automobile use. And in fact, the data and methods that are used don't give us any information about how to account for anything other than cars.
Really? There's no pedestrian and there's no...
Absolutely.
At all?
No transit, no bikes.
I'm a little bit stunned that, and it's a little bit of me living in a Portland bubble, but that's shocking to me because there's, what about New York and Chicago and LA and places where people live in higher density areas?
Absolutely. So this is one of the issues and part of the reason why we end up with a urban form like we see in Tucson and like we see in other places. So that's a whole other topic for discussion because that piece of the study has also had a big impact.
We can talk more about that later, but back to methodology.
Yeah. So we picked these because, I think one of the sort of misgivings is why didn't I pick retail? And one of the problems with retail is, shopping for books is different than shopping for furniture, which is different than shopping mm-hmm. for clothing. And so it was a little hard then to account for those differences in one study. So with supermarkets, it's, we all shop for food and we all have our preferences and it's a very frequent non-work kind of trip. And so I was interested in that. From that angle, it was a set of land uses that we were interested in. So we picked about 80 establishments in the metro area, so not all in the city of Portland, because we wanted to look at locations that had a variety of urban form characteristics that we expected to have a variety of different mode shares, patrons that arrive at mode shares by different modes. Like many studies of this kind, though, we had a hard time getting national chains to participate. So we had to draw heavily on local businesses.
Interesting. Why the reluctance from national chains?
I think it's just easy to say no. So, they're not vested locally. They don't know Portland State. They don't know me. Their headquarters are located somewhere else. So getting through the tangle of corporate, getting the right person to say yes is a challenge.
So why did people say yes, the ones who said yes?
I think they said yes because they're very interested in this question. So we had two big local chains that participated with us, Plaid Pantry, who's very interested, or at least the people there are very interested in transportation questions, and New Seasons. So also interested in knowing more about who's arriving and how are they arriving and so on.
Well, in both those places, I would think would have a vested interest and it'd be super helpful to them to know how much parking they needed or how to invest in new stores.
Absolutely. So I don't want to speak for Plaid Pantry or for New Seasons, but I know that, Plaid Pantry had some frustration with this development process in feeling like they were being overcharged for traffic impacts. And so was happy for us to collect some data for them as well. So what we did at these establishments is, unfortunately, the data that we collected is only for the evening peak hour. It's not for 24 hours or during the whole hours of operation for the businesses. And so the downside of that is we don't have a full, complete composite picture of what's going on at the stores. And so we can imagine that people that arrive by different modes might choose to arrive at different times of day. But the reason we chose the evening peak is these methodologies for evaluating transportation impacts are based on the evening peak. So we wanted to have some parity with that data and that information. And so we counted all the people coming through the doors. So we had a complete counting of what we would call person trips, so number of people patronizing these establishments. And we were counting the modes, or at least the cars, so the number of
cars.
And
how did you divide those modes up?
So we looked at walking, biking, driving, and then the various transit modes, so bus, light rail, whatever was appropriate for that location.
Okay.
So then after customers did what they needed to do in the business, we intercepted them on the way out and asked them to fill out a survey. And so we used these nifty computer tablets, and we had a set of questions that we asked about where they came from and where they're going next, what modes of transportation. So we captured not just the mode.
On that trip.
Yeah. So, but if it was a multimodal trip, so you walked to transit, you got off the bus, and then you walked to this establishment, we have all those bits and pieces of complex trips. So the results that you see analyzed in the report that we have sort of boils it down to the mode that is the larger portion of the trip. But there's some rich data there that could help us look at all the bits and pieces that comprise a trip. So we asked them those questions. We asked we asked how much did they spend there that day? For how many people were they purchasing things for? So if you're buying groceries for a family of four, we can't compare that to a single person buying a sandwich. And then how often do they patronize that business, that specific business? So we ended up with a very rich data set across the region that allowed us to look at not just things at the establishment level. So what are some of the factors that would contribute to these different mode shares that we would see around the region? But then at the individual consumer level, how much does mode seem to, what are the differences that we see in these customer behaviors relative to their mode of transportation?
So spending behaviors?
Spending behaviors and then the frequency.
Oh, okay, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was the study design, effectively. So we still have data that we can mine and that we have to analyze. But the upshot was that we saw that people who are – and so the question is, I think this is the thing, right? There's an assumption by many local businesses that that if we are investing in bike infrastructure, if we're investing in non-auto infrastructure
– Or transit
or walking, that we're taking away from their bread and butter of their business, and that people who arrive by car, the car is a signal of affluence, and we don't want to impede our best customers getting to the store. And so I think the big takeaway from this point, from the study, if there is one, is just that these non-motorized customers or non-auto customers are competitive. So either they're spending more per trip or they're making more trips per month, which results in perhaps a higher expenditure over the course of the year.
Did any of those findings surprise you?
I really didn't know what to expect with the study, to be quite honest. I mean, there is a perception that cyclists are just young males with no money who are drinking PBR, right?
And which isn't entirely untrue.
Right. Yeah.
That's a whole other study of what segment are actually young PBR drinking white males, but yeah.
Or are sitting in coffee shops all day but not really spending any money.
Right.
And so we really showed that there are some interesting differences by mode. And I think the biggest surprising factor was just the frequency. So it makes sense if you're going grocery shopping and you're not driving, you'd have to go more often. But the thing that was more surprising to me was for things that wouldn't matter, like going to the restaurants or going to bars, we saw the people that walk and bike go more frequently.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Wow, that does open a whole can of worms on more questions than
right.
than answers, doesn't it?
It does, because we don't, you know, there's this discussion of the green dividend. So why are they going more often if it's not related to directly to the mode or the carrying capacity of the mode? So is it that they have more money in their pockets because they're not spending it on owning and operating a vehicle? Well, I'm not so sure that that's true either, because many a cyclist in Portland own a car as well.
Well, I wonder, as someone, I just had my mother here from out of town for 10 days, and we spent a lot of time in the car because she's not a cyclist and she's not as interested in taking public transportation. So we used a car a lot. And I found it was much more difficult, and I felt less incentive to make extra stops or even go to places where I'd say, oh, I'll just stop in there and get a cup of coffee. I didn't want to because I had to park.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kelly Clifton, PSU professor and transportation researcher.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, Kelly, do people understand your findings?
I think any academic study, it gets very difficult because it tends to be very nuanced. And so we've been trying really hard to be clear about what the study says. But I do find that a lot of people are misrepresenting the upshot of the studies.
In what way?
Overstating, I think, the impacts, particularly with respect to bikes. So You know, people, particularly in Portland and particularly in the cycling community, were very excited by the finding. And so, you know, I think that as a researcher, I tend to be very cautious about how I interpret things.
Which is good. That's what makes you a great researcher.
So I do think the findings are great, but probably not as great as people think, you know, want to embrace them. So so one of the things that UTRECH tries to do, and we try to do, is be very clear in how do we translate these kind of complicated statistical studies into useful policy-relevant information.
So what is your translation of spending habits, really, in comparison? It sounds like cyclists and maybe pedestrians take more trips. What was the overall spending, though, comparison from car to non-vehicle trips?
So so I don't have the study in front of me to give you all the breakdown in numbers, but so when you account for sort of differences and, like, at the end of the day, there's not a huge amount of difference. And I think that the other thing is in most of the places that we studied, cars were still overwhelmingly the majority of the customer base were arriving by car. So I think so we do see big differences across the urban area in mode shares. So some places in central Portland, majority of people were coming by biking and walking. But I would just say that the big finding for me was probably the frequency question. So what that means is we patronize the same, because the way we ask that question, how often do you come to this particular establishment? So perhaps that means that people who walk and bike patronize their local businesses more often, so places near and proximate them to them. What it might mean is that people in cars go to a more variety of places. So again, it's complex. I think the mode differences aren't as important as the characteristics of the patron. So when we did more complicated modeling, we showed that it wasn't so much the mode, but the characteristics of the people that are taking the different modes.
What does that mean?
Well, I think what it means...
What kind of characteristics?
Well, income, gender, age seem to matter more than mode.
Interesting.
And this result is self-reporting as part of the study?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So we have all this information. So when we get too wonky in terms of statistics, but so the descriptive statistics definitely showed on the average differences in how much people are spending and how much people are going. So we can't negate that fact that cyclists are going more often, particularly to convenience stores and to bars. But it's not just the fact that they're coming by bike. It has to do more with why they're choosing bikes or who is the person that's...
On a bike?
On a bike,
or
exactly.
Using public transportation?
Absolutely, yeah.
So who can use your study and what should they... How do you think that they should use it? Are we talking businesses? Is this for jurisdictions?
Yeah, that's a great question. So again, I think it's the first study of its kind. Hopefully,
which is amazing that it's taken this long to have somebody look at that.
Right. I mean, there are other studies, but they're not, I would say, academic studies. But I hope it's not the last, because I think before this kind of information has a definitive answer for people that would drive policy, I think we need more research. But I'm going to always say that since I'm a researcher.
And I am
job security.
Yeah. But I do think the takeaways, I think it's useful in cities are having conversations with local business owners about changes that are coming, or trying to allay fears about we're putting in a bike corral or we're putting in bike infrastructure. There is some evidence to show that cyclists are competitive consumers. And so that, you know, it...
Well, and I think if a city knows that their projections are that their largest population is going to be between the ages of 20 and 30, at least for that period of 10 or 15 years, they can say, okay, well, then we need to make sure that we have infrastructure for public transportation, walking, pedestrian use, and biking.
Yeah.
And that's not a loss, maybe, to the businesses.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think it's useful in having these conversations with the public about what these changes might mean.
And actually, when I was hearing you state your findings, I was almost thinking from a business side, you know, in terms of stocking inventory. Like if you have people who are taking more frequent trips, maybe taking less per trip, but a greater frequency, that changes the flow and really functionally some operational business decisions.
Absolutely. So again, if you have customers in your store more often, even if they're not spending as much per trip, that is a loyal patron. So I think there's ways to capture that, to take advantage of that. We know that Pleb Pantry has made some important changes based on this study. So,
such as?
Well, they were surprised to find how many people were arriving by bikes. They weren't surprised by my spending numbers because they jived with their data. But they didn't know how people were arriving, and they didn't know how to attach those expenditures to people with modes. And so they realized, like, hey, cyclists are an important constituency for us. And so they've been installing more bike racks strategically at locations around the region.
They have one at 72nd and Southeast Powell, I will rejoice.
Yeah.
Dear Plaid Pantry. Sorry.
On a side note, staff needed to say.
And it
makes a lot of sense. I actually, one of my clients works at a Plaid Pantry, is a manager of a Plaid Pantry, and he was learning to commute by bike, and he has to take his bike inside and store it inside because there's no bike facilities there. But he has mentioned that, yeah, it's kind of in the pipeline to get more bike facilities. He's at a downtown location in places.
Yeah, they were a great partner for the study. And I think, you know, they came at this not from a bike advocacy standpoint, but from a business standpoint. And they tell a great story about how the study has helped them think about their customer base differently.
And that's fascinating. I mean, I'm glad Steph asked that question because, yeah, it could really impact how businesses see. You would think that they would want more of that information on their own, mm-hmm. like not just from your study, that they would want to maybe commission their own study to find that out.
I'm here.
So what has PDC, the Portland Development Commission, done with this study?
So that I'm not sure directly. So, you know, they're interested in the investments that they're making in Portland. They're interested in local economic development. And I think they're using it in the way that I just suggested. So using it in conversations that they're having. But I can't speak for them in terms of what they're doing with the specifics of the study.
Mm-hmm. So, and I think there's always a caution or a concern from researchers that I know that the unintended consequences of findings, and that you ideally want certain actions to happen as a result, but then there's all the sometimes the influence that bleeds over. Mm-hmm. So where do you think the influence of this study should end?
So what do you mean should end?
Were there, when you saw your findings, was there any way you thought that it could pivot to a way that you felt was not in keeping with the study, that would have gone beyond the bounds?
I think there are some real limits to what people could actually do with the information. I mean, it's just more information about behaviors that are already existing out there. There's a number of things I would like to do next in terms of following up with this. Like I said, it's just one study. I don't know that it's, maybe it is setting the world on fire, but I don't know that there's specific bounds where somebody's going to extrapolate and go too far with it.
Okay. So. Oh, that's great. Yeah. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show here on KBOO 90.7 in Portland, on the web at www.kboo.fm. Please stay with us for the second half of our show about biking around Oregon. Oh, but first, Tori Bortman will bring us this month's latest and greatest with the Bike Show News Minute after this music break. And here is Tori Bortman with the Bike Show News Minute.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the KBOO Bike Show News Minute for December 2013. Think high-visibility clothing will help you? According to one new study, and as our guest today, Kelly, will tell you, one new study is not enough to base a lot of judgment on, but one new study from the University of Bath and Brunel University in the United Kingdom, wearing high-visible clothing won't actually make you safer. The report finds that no matter what you're wearing, from a spandex-clad, experienced-looking cyclist to a high-vis-covered newbie, most cars pass at about the same distance, while 1 to 2% of these cars will pass dangerously close within about 20 inches of the rider, no matter what. They also found when comparing their study's results with the results of a 1979 study that vehicles are shockingly traveling an average of 2 feet closer to cyclists today than they were in 1979. The researchers conclude that there's little a cyclist can do to make riding safer and that it's in the hands of those who design our roads and drive on them to prevent collisions. Sounds like more future studies are needed. Local author and former KBOO Bike Show host Ellie Blue had a rude awakening when the attendant on the Amtrak train she was traveling on for business paged her on the overhead speaker at 11 p.m. to get her folding bikes immediately off the train. Unfortunately, it turned into an hour-long conflict because Amtrak policies indeed fully allow folding bikes in lieu of luggage in their travel cars, but the attendants in San Antonio, Texas had to be schooled on their own rules. Apparently, multiple Amtrak attendants, supervisors, and customer service agents were all convinced the folding bikes were not allowed, confusing them with policies for standard bikes, despite being pointed to their own website where the policy clearly states that bikes fold are welcome in the luggage racks. After negotiating to keep the bikes in the baggage area and losing much sleep, Ms. Blue was offered an email apology from Amtrak, but no actual compensation for her troubles and no guarantee from the company that it won't happen again. In an era when train ridership is decreasing, it seems as if Amtrak would be going out of their way to keep regular customers happy, but instead they are once again running off the rails. In other co-host news, my co-host Steph Routh has been chosen to sit on the Oregon Department of Transportation's policy committee that will help shape the Oregon bicycle and transport and pedestrian mode plan. This is very important work that will influence the future of how Oregonians get around. And it's clear that the state has made an excellent choice. Congrats from KBOO and the Bike Show. We couldn't be more proud.
Oh, shucks. Gulp.
And back with our guest today.
If you are just joining us, we are here all hour with PSU professor Kelly Clifton. And in the last half hour, we were talking about her recent study with the Oregon Transportation Research Education Consortium, OTREC, entitled Examining Consumer Behavior and Travel Choices. So good research, I think, is like good chocolate. You know, as soon as you get to the end of one, you're like, where's the next one? So what, you know, you get to the end of the study. When I read a study, I see the findings like, oh, well, that's very interesting. And then spend the next, you know, X number of hours with more questions that it's. So what questions have arisen as a result of this study? And what would you like if you had $2.5 million that you could give yourself? What would you be wanting to research next?
Oh, great. Well, I think one of the questions that that definitely came up in analyzing these data are about variations in mode use. So I think a lot of people who cycle in Portland are also pedestrians, also use transit, and also use their cars. So trying to understand over the course of the long term, what does that mean? And so I think that was one of the big limitations of the study is we just captured someone at one trip and we couldn't really say, well, how often are you coming by bike and how often?
How would you imagine a study that could capture that information? Because that seems huge to try to find out my, I think it's hard for me to remember how many ways I travel.
Right. Well, you know, for some reason in the U.S., we have an aversion to collecting data for more than one day. Americans have short attention spans and we can't keep them on board for a study for very long. But I do think, you know, mobile technologies are helping us. So we can have apps on our phone that keep track of our modes. There's some really good apps out there now. So having access to that kind of information over a month or even over a year would be fantastic. I'm really interested in the impacts of new infrastructure. So a lot of people wanted to know, well, what's the impact of taking away a car parking spot and putting in a bike corral for my business? So what does that mean in terms of changes in mode shares and then changes in customer base and expenditures? And I can't answer that question. Mm-hmm. You know, likewise, I'd like to know, like, we're building this new great bridge.
That is, if you're not from Portland, that's for pedestrians and transit and bicycles.
Yeah, it's going to be the largest non-auto bridge in the country.
Mm-hmm. Name pending.
Yeah. So what kind of impacts of that new infrastructure? What is that going to do? I think, you know, here in Portland, we're really interested. There's a lot of questions about, have we maxed out our bike mode share? Are we going to be ambitious enough to reach our goals of a 30% bike mode share or 25% bike mode share? And I got to comment on the City Club's study that was kind of looking at those next steps. And so one thing when you interpret my results of the study is it's based on who's cycling now. But it could be that the next group of people that enter into the fold have very different characteristics, right? They might look different. They might have different shopping patterns. So
interesting.
So how is that going to change what we think we know about cyclists?
You know, one study or probably a couple studies. Can I throw out my wish list?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So because
we love Steph's wish lists.
Oh, you're
it's
very
like
sweet.
Christmas.
I love this too. You were talking a little bit about the green dividend that Joe Courtwright and others did about, you know, reinvesting how much of dollars that are spent locally actually come back to local economy. I would be fascinated to hear, to learn how transportation choices and funding for transportation choices impacts locally owned businesses versus businesses owned whose headquarters are outside the metro region, and how that impacts then businesses we wish to either recruit or incubate. As you hear, like Washington County, for example, they have, you know, real vested interest into recruiting large campuses and, you know, big job generators to Washington County. But when we're talking about retrofitting that area to a more dense environment, you have that question of the smaller locally based businesses and how incubating that almost, you know, versus it, they don't have to be mutually exclusive, but in a limited economic environment where you have limited resources for economic development as a county, to what extent do you spend resources incubating those locally based businesses that can change the urban form, that can redefine how viable transportation choices are versus, and so these were some of my questions that came up as a result of your story. It's like, yeah, but what does economic development mean?
Yeah, and I think this raises two points, and hopefully I can remember what they are at the end of my discussion. But first of all, we have Mayor Rahm Emanuel saying we're going to invest in bikes in Chicago because we want to attract the creative class. You know, we think that there's a strong association between economic development and sort of attracting from the outside businesses and labor force that's, that sees this as a real amenity and wants to take advantage of it, and they value it. And so it's not just Portland that's kind of pursuing these things. And so whether or not that strategy pays off when framed that way is a big but very interesting question. And then the other thing is this green dividend question that you raise, and I would love to do a study of not just one-time spending, but sort of entire household expenditures. We really don't have good information about, you know, a lot of times we talk about the cost of owning and operating a car, and that money could be used differently. We could go out to eat with it. We could invest in bigger housing or better housing or more accessible housing. But we really don't have a good idea about what our transportation choices. How does that translate into cash flow and other kinds of activities? And so it would be a difficult study to pull off, I think linking sort of overall household well-being and expenditures to transportation and activity choices would be interesting.
I cannot even imagine. I think much like this, I think we have a lot of, there's a lot of assumptions on what your study was going to find, that affluent cars that was going to spend more money because they could also buy more. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of assumptions there. I think that I would make a lot of assumptions based on what I know or what I imagine of households. And I would also bet that a lot of my assumptions might be disproven if someone actually got the money to research and find that out.
Yeah, and I think there's really strong equity implications of this kind of study.
We're a household with a car that if we put our bikes on the car, they're worth double what the car is. and I don't think that we're alone.
Right.
And I think maybe overall we maybe have the same budget as a different household, but we just allocate it differently because of our priorities.
Yeah. And so what does that mean for local economic development? So where are you allocating? And so, you know, all of that money might get put into a local economy, but there might be real differences in how it's distributed.
I'm so glad you brought that up. So how, because there's been a lot of discussion about economic development in funding decisions at the local, state, federal level, especially since the recession, you know, there's the mantra of, you know, it's a jobs bill.
Yeah.
Everything that needs to be a jobs bill. But how, there's also who gets the jobs and what does economic development mean for different communities? So how do you feel that economic development, this is more of a beyond your research, just as a
speculation.
Yeah, that's correct. as a person in the field who sees trends, how does economic development intersect with equity, and how do you feel personally as a practitioner as well? How do you feel jurisdictions should balance that economic development with other priorities?
Yeah, so I'm a transportation researcher, not an economic development researcher.
That's your next career.
Maybe.
Now that you've done science,
yeah,
and transportation.
So I might answer this more from a transportation perspective. So, you know, cities around the country are embracing multimodal transportation. We see most of those investments going in places that are already economically robust, and so so as always, we are challenged to think about the less fortunate, the people at a financial disadvantage. And so one of the things we're seeing in cities is that you know, one of the good things we're seeing in cities is that there's a reinvigoration of the core of cities. But that one of the negative consequences of that has been we're seeing low-income people, communities of color, being pushed to the suburbs or into less accessible locations.
And you're seeing that census data, like very
yeah, baseline. Yeah, that's not speculation. And so, you know, thinking about what role sustainable transportation plays in these communities in facilitating local access. So, you know, there's two pieces to the equation here. It's having the infrastructure to support sustainable modes and having destinations nearby that you can get to. And I think that the two go hand in hand. But I think it's a difficult, has been a difficult policy decision for a variety of reasons. So I've been interested in this topic for a long time, and I actually did my dissertation a long time ago on how low-income households access grocery stores. And so looking at food deserts in Austin, Texas. And so when you interview low-income people, one of the challenges to local stores is either you're not getting the same quality or the same price often at grocery stores.
Mm-hmm.
And so where you're talking about people who are really financially constrained, they're willing to travel out farther to save money. And so there again becomes this accounting a question, you know, what is the right answer to supporting their economic well-being? So I think, you know, here in Portland in particular, we need to think about investing in cycling infrastructure and pedestrian infrastructure for a variety of reasons. But I think it's going to take a while before we see that translate in real economic development. That's a whole other policy strategy.
This is very close to I'm on the Portland Bureau of Transportation Budget Advisory Committee. And last month we're having a conversation today that's probably hopefully going to be a continuation, that we have these community rankings and of what priorities are for the city. And these were created, you know, a couple of years ago. We've been fine-tuning.
So when you say community rankings, which communities?
Good question. So, like, what are the services or what are the operations that the city is providing or spending money on? And, you know, how do we prioritize those things? So, you know, tram operations or sidewalk construction,
okay,
you know, pothole maintenance, curb ramps, lighting, precisely. So, and all of these, we have to decide, you know, which are the priorities. And creating that ranking in a recession or when we're cutting funding, you know, you're talking about maintaining what we already have. We just don't want to lose what we have. We can't build new. But what that also means, so, you know, it's a lot about maintenance. You know, we've been talking a lot about street maintenance. What it doesn't include, so we're maintaining what we already have, but what it doesn't maintain is what we haven't built yet. It doesn't plan for changing needs. It doesn't it doesn't fulfill the promises that we made, you know, 30, now, good heavens, 40 years ago to Outer East Portland and parts of Southwest. So how do we prioritize that from a purely economic model? Asset maintenance is so important, and yet there are different priorities, and there are priorities to include more communities of Portland. Anyway, you should come, both of you, to an upcoming budget advisory committee. So I think
this sounds fun.
This is going to be fun. It actually kind of is. You know. That's what I. I'm going to go down a rabbit hole. It's like, so what do you think we should be talking about today at the Budget Advisory Committee?
And maybe at the Budget Advisory Committee, and I'll make a suggestion, is talking about this study a little bit and using that as a base of saying, okay, I mean, what are the other studies that are projections for the future of how Portland's going to be moving, and combining that with this study and saying, okay, if we put these two studies together, what are our needs now? What are our needs in 5 years, 10 years? And looking at that as a whole.
Yeah, well, the next step for this research is I'm involved in a project with two of my colleagues, Chris Monsier and Jennifer Dill at Portland State, and it's called the Green Lane Project. So it is another NITSE-sponsored project, but we are also co-sponsored by...
NITSE.
National Institute for Transportation and Community.
I was like, is that a bug?
As opposed to NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
But also supported by Bikes Belong and the Summit Foundation. And so we are evaluating the green lanes or the protected bike lanes that are going in.
I was like, which green did you mean?
Yeah. So we're looking at the infrastructure investments in separated bike lanes that are going in Chicago, D.C., Austin, Memphis, San Francisco, and Portland. I'm less involved in the aspects that are looking at the safety and operations of how these new infrastructure are working. But there is a piece of money set aside to look at the economic impacts of this infrastructure. And so we're going to take a different approach. So instead of intercepting customers, we're going to try to look at sales tax. So unfortunately, Portland won't allow us to do that since we don't have sales tax. But it'll be nice to sort of go somewhere else and look and see, do the results that I, you know, is there parity between what we found here in Portland and what we might find somewhere else?
I think that's really important.
Yeah.
It's
exciting. And the question is, you know, how long after this infrastructure is in place is the right time to evaluate its impact? Because we know that it's, you know, it takes a while for people to adjust and the community to embrace new infrastructure. And then the other thing that we're looking at is what is this idea of bike-supported development? So can we break it down into its components and sort of define what it is? You know, how is it different? I used to teach a course on transportation and land use, and I would ask my students every year to write an essay on can we accommodate bicycles by doing good pedestrian planning? Not thinking in terms of like sort of densities and nodal development and mixed use, or do bikes need something else? And so I don't have a good answer for that. This is a, and so I want to You know, you think about bikes having very different modal characteristics, and so they can go farther distances. They could probably tolerate lower densities, right?
When you do this study, we're going to have you back because yeah. this is a huge discussion in the cycling community right now. It's very live. I know. Our last guest, Randy Cohen, was talking about how bikes should be viewed as a completely separate entity. We're not cars, we're not pedestrians, and we should have a whole something that's just for bikes or whatnot. But like, I feel like he's not alone in that thought process. And so.
Yeah, and I think, you know, back to something we were talking about before, so thinking about Tucson or more suburban low-density development, maybe those are actually really ripe for more bike investment because transit doesn't work very well there. It's difficult to be a pedestrian in those kinds of places. But bikes don't have as many obstacles to traveling those distances. It's just the connections that are missing.
Mm-hmm.
And there tends to be plenty of right-of-way in those places.
Well, we have done it again. I have 5,000 other questions. I'm sure Tori does as well. And we've blown through an entire hour. Kelly Clifton, PSU professor and transportation researcher, thank you so much for being here today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is fun.
And in the last few minutes, Tori Bortman has come up with the KBOO Bike Show's very own Give Guide.
So as many of our listeners, especially in Portland, know, the Willamette Week does a great job of doing a holiday give guide. And there's two big nonprofit organizations, the Community Cycling Center and the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, that are included in that guide and kind of get the spotlight. But we wanted to highlight some organizations that are great and poor in Portland and growing and up and coming that can use your help. The first one is the Bike Farm. It's an all-volunteer run bicycle maintenance collective dedicated to every aspect of bicycle education, from safe commuting to repair and more. Their mission is to provide a space where people can learn about the bicycle and build community around promoting sustainable transportation. In their own words, "We strive to demystify the bicycle in order to impact the city in a healthy and positive way by offering space and to help to repair your bike." You can donate to the Bike Farm if you're interested at bikefarm.org. You can donate parts, bicycles, anything on their wish list. They have a really great wish list, and they're kind of rebuilding from a unfortunate fire, and they're almost there, but they can use a few things, as well as money or your time. Bikes for Humanity is an all-volunteer organization providing affordable refurbished bicycles to riders of all economic backgrounds. Their mission is to sustainably increase public access to affordable and safe bicycles while empowering self-sufficiency in bicycle maintenance and commuting skills. To find out more about volunteering your time or donating bike parts to Bikes for Humanity, you can go to sites.google.com/site/bikes4humanity and another backslash. New Avenues for Youth offers programs and services that empower homeless youth to exit street life, believing that every young person should have food, shelter, and access to education and job training. The organization goes beyond meeting basic needs and offers programs that heal young lives and fosters growth and independence, including a bicycle program and including bike locks on their wish list, because bikes are the most affordable transportation option for many of their young charges. Look for their wish list under holiday giving at newavenues.org. That's newavenues.org. And a little bit out of town, the Washington County Bicycle Transportation Coalition, also known as WashCo BTC, whose mission is to promote bicycle transportation, protect bicyclists' rights, and improve bicycling conditions throughout Washington County. They're kind of the Washington County, and started out as a little subset of our Bicycle Transportation Alliance and have gone off on their own now and have done a lot of growth and have a lot of things to offer. They offer education, advocacy, and community, and they have a retail bike shop and offer programs in cycling education and repair as well. This winter, they're also having an Adopt-a-Bike program, which will provide 50 kids with bikes, helmets, and skills clinics for the holidays. You can donate to them or that Adopt-a-Bike program at www.washcobtc.org. We'll be putting these organizations and their contact info up on our Facebook page later today if you didn't catch any of that info and you're interested in making a donation. Happy holidays to one and all.
Tori, that was awesome.
Thanks.
And just a tiny shout out, you had talked about the BTA and the Community Cycling Center. This evening is the Community Cycling Center's sneak peek fundraiser for their holiday bike drive. And this Sunday is the holiday bike drive proper, which I dub the River of Cute. You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show. We're on the air the first Wednesday of every month. Our show is generously edited by Josh Hetrick and archived by Portland Transport. Online at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. You can also find recent episodes free on iTunes. I personally use Stitcher. The Bike Show is produced by Tori Bortman, Michelle Poyero, Michael Tete, and me, Steph Routh. Special thanks again to the delightful Tori Bortman for co-hosting and to Kelly Clifton for joining us for the entire hour. We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer, Tammy Dean. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the bike world. Work hard, be happy, and ride your bike, people.
And you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from, Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Stay tuned for the news at noon and then jazz with Nick Geffro. Thanks for tuning in today.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, December 4th. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, on Monday, the Board of Cover Oregon approved a 3-month medical leave for the director of the agency, Rocky King, and hinted that it may be necessary to find a permanent replacement for Oregon's health insurance coverage exchange. King indicated that the medical leave was a result of a previous medical condition. During his absence, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, the director of the Oregon Health Authority, will serve as acting director. He was one of the individuals Governor Kitzhaber nominated earlier to help lead the agency out of its technical quagmire. The Board of Cover Oregon is forming a temporary search committee and indicated they will look for a permanent hire for the position.
In national news, a recent poll showed that people who responded won above all else Congress to focus on creating jobs. They don't necessarily know the best strategy to achieve this, nor do they care. Almost an equal number favored a conservative approach, cutting taxes and regulation, as compared to a more liberal approach such as boosting spending on infrastructure projects. Meanwhile, the United Technologies National Journal Congressional Connection poll found that the initiatives seen as least popular were the GOP priorities of reducing the federal deficit and repealing the Affordable Care Act. The poll also found that 48% of the respondents felt alienated by Republicans and see the GOP's primary goal as antagonizing Obama. 32% feel the party is drifting away from representing their views, as opposed to 16% who feel the party represents them. Republicans seem to care little about these priorities, but only about what their Republican primary voters in the conservative districts want.
In international news, at a ceremony Tuesday presided over by the UN peacekeeping chief and a minister of defense for the Democratic Republic of Congo, United Nations peacekeeping forces launched drones to begin monitoring the Congo's border with Rwanda and Uganda. This is the first time UN peacekeeping forces have used unmanned aircraft to support any peacekeeping efforts. The aircraft will be monitoring these borders because of suspected Rwanda and Uganda arms and troop movements across the border, which are seeking to assist the recently defeated M23 rebels in the Congo. Victory over M23 was the result of strong UN support. Rwanda and Uganda both deny any activity into this mineral-rich country. The UN has come under increasing criticism for not doing more to control the nearly 2-decades-old fighting in the Congo.
Vice President Joe Biden will be visiting South Korea and Japan this week to reassure them that the United States will stand behind them in their controversy with China. China has recently claimed an area of East China Seas as their sovereign territory. The waters and tiny islands in this area are currently declared as belonging to Japan and South Korea. China is maintaining that the area is an air defense identification zone, indicating other nations may not fly into the space without China's approval. The U.S. and Japan have both recently entered a designated airspace without China's consent and suffered no ill consequences. The fear is that any movement by these countries into China's declared airspace will increase the risk of accidents, miscalculations, or even war. Another purpose of Biden's trip is to combat criticism that the U.S. is neglecting Asia as a result of the president having to deal with domestic policies and the Middle East.
Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with world diplomats to encourage leaving some international troops in Afghanistan after 2014. The issue is one of the major topics for an annual two-day NATO summit meeting in Brussels that begins next Tuesday. The U.S. would like to see several thousand troops remain there to advise local troops and assist with security concerns. The U.S. is demanding a final decision by the end of the month, but President Hamid Karzai keeps finding reasons to balk at the U.S. proposal. If a decision cannot be reached by the U.S. deadline, President Obama has threatened to withdraw all troops in spite of the risks to the Afghan government. The Afghan president says he wants to postpone any signing until after the April elections.
This is Diane Erickson
and Patrick Wilson
with the KBOO News at Noon, produced by volunteers in our Southeast studio in Portland, Oregon. Tune in every night at 5 o'clock for more local, national, and international news. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7